All right, here this document is designed to prepare us, give you a little bit of background about the Apostle Paul, Saul of Tarsus, who was his given name. Saul came from a city named Tarsus. And many people think, as they read the Bible, Paul was a great believer, and he was. But I don't think a lot of people would have liked Paul. He wouldn't be very popular today, I can tell you that. Paul was a no-nonsense kind of fellow. He didn't tolerate stupidity too much. And he didn't mind making his point known and making it known plainly. He understood who he was in doctrine as a part of God's plan, and thus functioned with a great deal of confidence that most people would probably today mistake for arrogance. But Paul was not arrogant, as it becomes clear. All right, well, let's start out with the birth of Saul of Tarsus and his early years. It should be observed at the outset that it is not possible to construct a complete biography of Paul, since a good deal of information about his life is simply not available. B, there is no extant historical information about the birth of Saul of Tarsus, but many historians place his birth about the same time as that of Jesus Christ. The best suggestions seem to place his birth in about 3 to 2 B.C. Jesus was born in 3 B.C. And a range is generally offered between 5 B.C. and 5 A.D. They give you roughly a 9-year span there. Most people fit it into this time frame. See, since Paul was born as a Roman citizen, he was likely given two names at birth, which was common during this time in history. D. Paul's Roman name was likely Saul Paulus. The Hebrew Saul comes from the verb Shaul, which means asked for or desired. And the Roman name Paulus means small. It was not unusual for Roman citizens to have two names, or sometimes even they would have three. One would tell you about their family, but Paul was not from a Roman family. He was from a Jewish family. He was apparently born a citizen, rather than becoming one later. There were ways people could become citizens of the Roman Empire during the course of their life. Some were made citizens, others could buy citizenship. There were ways one could go about it. You could be adopted into a family that would provide citizenship. But most Romans would have three names, and one would include their family name, like, for instance, Gaius Julius Caesar. That would be a typical Roman name. With a praenomen, nomen, and cognomen. And the cognomen is just a nickname, sort of. And Paul seems to be, Paulus would have been Paul's nickname, not his given name. He was racially from the tribe of Benjamin and indicates that he was a Jew of Jewish parents. His father was a Pharisee, the strictest sect of Judaism at that time. So knowing that sort of information, which we find in Acts 23:6, where Paul is providing some insight here. And actually what he's doing is pulling a stunt, but we won't go into all of that as to why he's pulling this stunt. But Paul's out of fellowship, and he's out of the geographic will of God, and he's in trouble. And he, rather than admit it and turn around and say, I made a mistake, Paul just keeps plowing ahead with it. So one of the things we'll see about Paul is that he wasn't perfect. He definitely was not perfect. He had his share of problems. He fought the sin nature just like we do when we get into Romans. We're going to get a big dose of his how he viewed life with the sin nature and how he dealt with it. But one thing we will see, it was a regular feature of his life, and he knew it. So here Paul is should be going to Rome, but he's chosen to come to Jerusalem. Which was not the will of God for him. Well, once he crossed that line, got out of that track, he stays off track until at some point he recovers and eventually gets headed to Rome. Now, his trip to Rome is going to be far more difficult than it would have been otherwise. Because, number one, when Paul writes, for instance, we're going to see this, when Paul writes his letter to the Romans, he's in the Greek province of Achaia, and he's halfway to Rome already. He's much closer to Rome than he is when he's in Jerusalem. The fact is, as Paul is here in trouble, and he resorts to his own devices to try to get out of this trouble. Well, it doesn't really work too well for him, as we're going to see. This is the problem with the believer out of fellowship. Until they acknowledge they've made a mistake and go back and get back on the right path, they're going to stay out of it. And they can continue to do all manner of things. You continue to go through the gyrations, say, I'm going to fix it myself. But no, you've gotten off the track and you need to deal with that. Until you deal with it, you're in trouble. And one of the things we see when Paul's in trouble here, he resorts to this divide and conquer tactic inside the council here. But Paul says, perceiving that one group were Sadducees and the other were Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, Brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead. Well, that wasn't what he was actually on trial for. But let's not let, you know, Paul's gyrations here confuse us as he seeks to manipulate the council now because he's in trouble. Well, guess what? In verse 9, there occurred a great uproar. And 10, there was such great dissension, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn into pieces by them. His little stunt here almost got him killed. And so this is one of the things people don't take God. See, they don't have a fear of God. They don't say, well, you know, what could God do? I can get out of fellowship and do my own little thing and go off here on this little tangent out in the Thule's. And you can. But what may God do about that? And the answer is God is more severe than we are. So here, Paul almost gets ripped to shreds. God protects him. Obviously, even, and this is another, there's a big lesson here in this as well. Even when the believer blows it and makes really stupid decisions, there's grace after the fact. But the point is, you know, as you grow, you want to try to avoid the stupid decisions. That's the key thing. That'll save you a lot of wear and tear. So in verse 11, you actually see, in this verse almost, when I remember when I was doing Acts many years ago, this verse really stands out as being out of the normal flow of narrative. That it's set apart here for a purpose. And on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, Take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also. So Paul knew then, until I get to Rome, I'm pretty well immortal. But his trip to Rome is not without incident. Let's just say it that way. Not to mention that poisonous snake bite he got out there that probably couldn't have felt good, even if it didn't kill him. It couldn't have felt good. So again, he acknowledges that he's a Pharisee. There is no information about Paul's mother, but it is reasonable to conclude that a Pharisee would have only married a woman of the highest standards, who likely shared his Pharisaic views. Because he uses the plural there, I am a son of Pharisees, which implies that both his father and mother were Pharisees. Philippians 3:5. He says he was circumcised the eighth day. That was the day they're supposed to be circumcised. And circumcision always occurred on the eighth day. And when you find out now from medical science that there's a perfectly good reason for this. That's when the clotting factors are at their highest. That's when they reach peak plasma levels. Of the nation of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. That means a Hebrew of Hebrew parents. So we know that his mom and dad were both, again, strict racial Hebrews from the tribe of Benjamin. And as to the law, a Pharisee, and it appears that they both were Pharisees and that he was raised in this very strict legalistic environment. Well, how do you think that's going to turn out? Turns out to be a strict legalist. What a shock. Well, gee, it is clear that Paul was born into a very strict legalistic Jewish home and was raised to emulate his father's life as a Pharisee. H, there's not much information on his family, but Luke does mention in Acts that he had at least one sister. Who also had a son. That was when he's in Jerusalem there. This is another time he almost gets killed. Second time his life's in jeopardy in Jerusalem. But this is what happens when you're places you don't need to be. This kind of thing can happen. Acts 23:16. But the son of Paul's sister heard about their ambush or their plans to ambush the Roman guard. And he came and entered the barracks and told Paul. And that's another interesting incident, but we just want to say here that we do know that he had at least one sister. Paul mentioned some relatives in the book of Romans, but it is difficult to determine if they are blood relatives or if the Greek term syngenes is to be understood as his extended Jewish family. Romans 16, at the end of the book, he gives a lot of greetings to be passed on. And again, syngenes means to be born with, literally. So again, is this family actual family members? It seems more likely that he's speaking of the wider family of Jewish people rather than simply his strict mother, father, sister family. Romans 16:7, greet Andronicus and Junicus, my kinsmen. Well, again, is he just saying that these are fellow Jews or that they are actual relatives? I think he's just saying they're fellow Jews. Also, verse 11, greet Herodian, my kinsman. And then 20, or let's see, what do you got here? 11, 21, Timothy, my fellow worker, greet you. So do Lucius, Jason, and Sosipater, my kinsmen. But Sosipater and Lucius, and in fact, Jason, are not Jewish names. Those are Roman names. So, again, who's he referencing? The term is broad enough to make it difficult to say. And if you compare that to Romans 9, 3, and 4, where he uses that term, syngenes, he talks about Israelites in verse 3, for I could wish that I myself were accursed, separated from Christ for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh. And while I don't have any doubts that Paul is serious here and that he means business, this is almost a ludicrous comment for somebody to make. And I think it betrays the fact that Paul was way too emotionally involved with this trip to Jerusalem than he should have been. Because he puts this first over the trip to Rome, which he's supposed to be doing. And he even tells them at the beginning of this book, when we get into Romans, he tells them, hey, I've wanted to come there for quite a while, but it hadn't worked out. But he's finished up his work. He tells them, I finished up this work in this area where I've been working. And so now would be a good time for me to go to Rome. But he doesn't go to Rome. He goes to Jerusalem. Because I think Paul had a little bit of a martyr complex too. That was something I think he developed. Whether he always had it or outgrew it, I hope he outgrew it. Because he tells them, oh, I'm ready to go to Jerusalem and die. Well, that sounds noble. But is it? No. Again, more often, it's far more difficult to live for Jesus on a day-to-day basis and make the sacrifices than it is to die once. Let's face it. Once you're dead, it's over. But you have to live this out. So I think here when Paul, he talks about how he feels about his kinsmen, and I believe he's being real and he's being honest. But this business of, I could wish that I were accursed. So he's saying, essentially, I'd be willing to go to hell if all my kinsmen could get saved. But can that happen? No, that can't happen. So why say it? I think it's a little bit overblown, and I think it shows that Paul had a little bit got off track on his thinking, on how serious. He's not the apostle to the Jews, by the way. That's another whole thing that has to be factored into this. He's the apostle to the Gentiles. God doesn't need Paul in Jerusalem. There's 7 or 8 apostles still around there, as far as we know. Maybe more. We don't know exactly how many there were at that time or where they all were. But it doesn't appear that they were short on leadership in the Jerusalem church. So does he need Paul there? No, he doesn't. Doesn't need him at all. For my brethren, as he calls him here, my kinsmen, syngenes, according to the flesh. And so again, we'll deal with this more as we get into it. But there he clearly limits it to just Jews at large. And that's why I think he's using it the same way in Romans 16 there. Well, Jay, before Paul reached the age of 13 and went to Jerusalem for his theological training, he was raised in the family business of tent making according to Jewish custom. Jewish boys were generally, if they were not smart and they were not going to have a career in what we might call the ministry, becoming a scribe a lawyer, a religious expert. They weren't going to go to seminary. They learned the family trade, whatever that was. Well, in Paul's family, the family trade was tent making, which actually was a very good deal for Paul. Because he had, number one, obviously, one of the things all kids ought to learn is some basic physical skill that they can rely on to make a living in the world. Whatever that may be. Again, that has to be tailored to the individual child, how smart they are, what their motivations are, where their interests lie, a bunch of factors. What they can afford. I mean, it's crazy to think, okay, well, it costs $100,000 now to go to college. Let's say it's probably more than that. I don't know what it costs. But you can't afford to go to college. Well, okay, then you have to make, okay, well, now what do I want to do? Do I want to go to a community college, or do I want to just go to a vocational technical school and learn a trade so I can go to work? So decisions have to be made. Well, in this case, if they weren't going to be, quote, in the ministry, then they were going to learn the family trade. And most of them had to learn the family trade anyway. But Acts 18:3 tells us about that. And because he was of the same trade, it's talking here about this couple. He found a Jew named Aquila, in verse 2, a native of Pontus, having come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. So he came to them because he was of the same trade, and he stayed with them, and they were working. For by trade, they were tent makers. And so Paul had this skill that he could fall back on if the ministry, and Paul's ministry was one where he was not consistently on what we would call full maintenance. He was not able to support himself all the time by the various churches that supported him weren't or didn't. And so, for instance, the Corinthians, he never took a penny from them. But that was a personal matter. He had reasons and doctrinal reasons for doing that. So anyway, he was probably a very good tent maker, by the way, because the tents from Tarsus were known as being very high quality. And the Romans regularly did business with these people because they liked them. They liked their tents. So this was something where when Paul wouldn't be on full maintenance, he could work making tents during the day or the evening whenever he chose to work. And then the rest of the time he could devote himself. And that's what he does here. They were working, but he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath. And so he would apparently work through the week and then use his opportunity on Saturday where they all came together. The Sabbath was a perfect day for it because the synagogue was a place they came ostensibly to find out about God. So you got an audience there that's already interested in your subject matter. But, unfortunately, you've got a hostile audience, as we're going to see. But when Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself completely to the word. Now, all that means was Paul, as we're going to find out, Silas and Timothy brought a monetary gift and delivered it to him. And so Paul didn't have to work anymore. He had enough money now to pay his bills and to not be a burden to anybody. This was another whole thing. Paul was very, very adamant about when he went into any new area, he would not take money from people during evangelism. In the initial evangelistic stages of a ministry, when he went to an area where they didn't know about the Lord, didn't know about Jesus, his life, his death, all these things, his burial, his resurrection, and he would go in and evangelize people. He made it. It was his policy never to take money. How opposite is that to what we see today? At the end of every evangelistic crusade, or before, they pass the hat around, which is exactly the opposite of what you should do. So you should never take money. Number one, as a policy we have, we don't take money. Certainly, we don't take money from people that we're trying to evangelize. And secondly, we don't even take money from people unless they're believers and are giving under the principle of grace giving with no strings attached. We will not knowingly take money from unbelievers. We don't believe that God's plan will need to be supported by unbelievers. That God will take care of us apart from that. And he always has. So Paul wouldn't ever make money an issue. So he had to be able to support himself when he traveled, wherever he went, where he stayed. Obviously, lodging costs money. Getting there costs money. And so Paul obviously made this his way of acting. And of course, he could do so because he had this great skill. He could make tents. And sell them and support himself. Well, two, he was born in Tarsus, the capital of Cilicia, which is a Roman province located in the southeast part of Asia Minor. And if you look on that next page, you've got a map there This has some of his travels in it. I'm not so much worried about that. But over on that far right side there, if you should see the province of Cilicia, and Tarsus is located just somewhat inland, but still had great access to the Mediterranean there. And that's important too, because obviously if you were an important trading city and all of that, and you were inland, that limited you to some extent as to what you could do. But the closer you were to the Mediterranean, the more ability you had to move around the ancient world, buying and selling of goods and all that. So commerce has increased in those seaport cities. Well, A, the city of Tarsus, where Paul was born, was a very important at that time in history, since it was one of the largest trade centers on the Mediterranean coast. B, it was a seaport city situated about 12 miles inland on the river Cydnus, which emptied into the Mediterranean. It had a harbor that was well protected by natural rock fortifications. Well, while the origins of Tarsus are really unknown, two of the extant references about it indicate that it was founded by a king of Assyria. However, the Greeks also claim to have founded the city. I'd be more likely to think it was the Assyrians, because they ruled before the Greeks, and this was certainly their empire stretched certainly all the way across Asia Minor there. Where the Persians ran into troubles when they tried to cross the Aegean and mess with the Greeks. That was where they made their fatal mistake. Then they ended up one day facing the wrath of Alexander for it. And of course he conquered their kingdom, took it away from them. But I'd be more likely to think that the Assyrian kings probably founded it. D, the earliest historical record is found during the time of Shalmaneser, circa 850 BC, where it is listed among the places captured by that king. E, during the lifetime of Alexander the Great, circa 350 or about 330 to 300 BC, somewhere in there, it was the most influential city in Asia Minor. Alexander Hellenized the city, introducing Greek thought, influence, and customs when he captured it and all of Asia Minor. And F, after the death of Alexander the Great, Seleucus, one of his generals, the kingdom of Alexander, was divided to the four winds of heaven, as it says. And it was divided among four of his generals. He took over the region that included Tarsus, proclaimed himself king, and established the Seleucid dynasty. And the Seleucids tended to rule down along through Israel into the northern part of Egypt. The Ptolemies, one of his other generals, ruled in Egypt. Cassander tended to rule over towards Macedon, and Thrace, Macedonia, over on the Greek peninsula there. And so they divided the kingdom of Alexander four ways. That's taught prophetically. Daniel 8:8 tells us about that. And actually, we'll have to look at that tomorrow night. Our time is gone, so let's just stop there, and we will continue here tomorrow evening. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to study these things. May God, the Holy Spirit, sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.